This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello and welcome. I appreciate you tuning in. I'm Joel Hilliker. I had a wonderful experience last Thursday night. In Armstrong Auditorium, we held our first dress rehearsal for a dance show we're staging called Celtic Throne. This show highlights our Irish dance program, but we have a handful of live musicians on stage. I have the opportunity to play baron and mandolin and to sing in a couple of songs. But being at this dress rehearsal was an exhilarating experience, seeing all of the elements coming together. All three of my children are dancing in the show. My wife is backstage helping with costumes. I was dumbfounded at the level of quality of this production, and it's going to get better before our premiere on Sunday, June 28th. If you're in the Edmond area in Oklahoma, I do hope that you will come. You can get tickets at armstrongauditorium.org, but I believe that the show will be available for streaming online. We'll link to that in the show notes if we can. But the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, attended that rehearsal. And after the show, he said, "This world is a frightening and a hopeless place right now. You look at everything that's happening, you see the riots and the anger that people are directing toward each other, social disorder, authorities that are abandoning their responsibilities, and it really feels like the social fabric is fraying in America today." And Mr. Flory said, "This show is tailor-made for these times. People are hungering for hope. And this show is truly uplifting and inspiring and positive. And it shows you what the world could be and should be. It's a preview of the wonderful world tomorrow," he said. And I've been thinking a lot about his comments. With so much bad news out there, we really do need to make sure we keep it all in perspective and to recognize what even these troubles in the world today are pointing to. So we have a special show today. We are going to talk about some of the bad news. We'll hear a report and have a conversation with Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about this push to defund the police that is gaining momentum. But for the main part of the program, after we hear about that, we're going to talk with some of the main people behind Celtic Throne. We'll talk to Brad McDonald and Amy Flurry, the directors of the program, as well as the assistant director and two of the choreographers. And I hope you will receive some uplift and inspiration from that conversation. And at the end of the show, my last word is going to be about keeping hope alive, keeping your chin up in the face of all the bad news. So let's begin by learning more about this aggressive push to defund the police in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
"You are paying instigators to be among our people out there, throwing rocks, breaking windows, and burning down buildings. And so young people are responding to that. They are enraged, and there's an easy way to stop it. Arrest the cops. Charge the cops. Charge all the cops. Not just some of them, not just here in Minneapolis. Charge them in every city across America where our people are being murdered. Charge them everywhere. That's the bottom line. Charge the cops. Do your job."
That was popular activist Tamika Mallory in a now viral video of her speaking at a Black Lives Matter rally. The video has been watched over 10 million times and has been shared by multiple users across social media. This has been in the wake of the tragic death of George Floyd, which sparked over 2 weeks of Black Lives Matter protests, demonstrations, and riots in America and across the world. His death and that of several blacks who have died at the hands of police has been identified as both a symptom and a consequence of endemic and systemic racism. According to Black Lives Matter, blacks are systematically targeted for demise by the state and especially by the police. Therefore, the proffered solution has been to remove the police from the equation altogether. That is the easy way to stop the violence, the rioting, the protesting, they say, to defund the police. The problem is that the idea of defunding the police seems to mean different things to different people. Late night talk show host John Oliver derided those who fear that defunding the police is a call for the dismantling of police forces entirely. Here is what he said.
Defunding the police absolutely does not mean that we eliminate all cops and just succumb to the purge. Instead, it's about moving away from a narrow conception of public safety that relies on policing and punishment and investing in a community's actual safety net, things like stable housing, mental health services, and community organizations. The concept is that the role of the police can then significantly shrink because they are not responding to the homeless or to mental health calls or arresting children in schools or really any other situation where the best solution is not someone showing up with a gun. That is the idea behind Defund the Police, if you actually listen to it.
Alex S. Vitale, author of The End of Policing, agrees, explaining, "It's time for everyone to quit thinking that jailing one more killer cop will do anything to change the nature of American policing. We must move instead to significantly defund the police and redirect resources into community-based initiatives that can produce real safety and security without the violence and racism inherent in the criminal justice system." The problem is that there is a discrepancy between people such as John Oliver and Alex Vitale and those at the head of the Black Lives Matter movement on what defunding the police actually means. As we heard Tamika Mallory say, her idea is to charge the cops everywhere. Patrice Cullors, co-founder of the organization Black Lives Matter, gave more insight to the ultimate goal of defunding the police, saying, quote, "We don't disband law enforcement in just one day. That's not logical. I think we should ultimately abolish law enforcement, but what we can do right now is drastically reduce law enforcement's relationship to the community," end quote. Minneapolis has already reacted. The Minneapolis Public School Board unanimously voted to terminate its contract with the police department. They will now no longer provide security to the school because the district, according to a board member, cannot align itself with the Minneapolis police and claim to fight institutional racism. Now, its city council has vowed to abolish the entire police department altogether. Los Angeles, New York City, San Francisco, Baltimore, and Philadelphia are all on the same trajectory. The absence of police officers is supposed to ultimately be synonymous with a reduction in criminality. But research shows that more police doesn't mean more arrests, but rather fewer crimes and therefore less need to arrest people. A 2005 study found that when Washington, D.C. police were mobilized in high alert periods, crime levels dropped significantly. A 2018 Princeton University study found that a 3.5% increase in police staff led to a 3.5% reduction in crime. Another 2018 study found that over the period of 1960 and 2010, every extra dollar spent on policing generated nearly $2 in social benefits, mainly through fewer murders. John Oliver and Alex Vitale and others like them believe that the ultimate goal of this movement is to just significantly shrink the role of the police. The facts show that even just that would have detrimental effects on society. But in reality, defunding the police might actually be just the first step in what would ultimately become a zero police society. This movement to eliminate police from society might seem to be an instantaneous reaction to perceived injustices, but the increasingly radical left has been agitating for this law enforcement vacuum for years and is now using incendiary language to fuel this movement. The raw data shows that the perceived injustices are not systemic, but rather incidental. Not symptomatic of a racist society, but, as in the case of George Floyd, isolated events of unwarranted aggression and abuse of power. But say the police are defunded and ultimately completely abolished. What is going to happen? As the Los Angeles Police Protective League wrote, "What will we say to that victim of domestic violence who waits even longer for a police response due to the shortages of personnel in the field? What do we say to the woman who was sexually assaulted, yet her assailant is still on the loose because resources are not available to locate him?" Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, wrote that past wrongs and present inequalities create fertile ground for hurt, frustration, and anger. And today, we see many prominent leaders, both black and white, deliberately fueling those grievances for their own political gain. What will happen when the police are rendered powerless and the military is unprepared? Mr. Flurry asks. Once the police are handicapped and can't do anything, it won't be long before cities burn, as it says in Isaiah 1 verse 7. There have been over 12 days of non-stop rioting and protesting so far, and despite the mainstream media insisting otherwise about the nature of these protests, they are indeed violent and the cities are burning. The system cannot be brought down without eliminating those who safeguard and protect law and order. That is what is behind this concentrated push to do away with law enforcement. The increasingly radical left is desperate to gain power and is willing to see the country burn if it can rule over the ashes.
Thank you very much for that, Rufaro. So the central charge here is black people are being killed in large numbers by racist police. And of course, they have all the names of the people who have died, the George Floyds and so on. What do the numbers say? What's the bigger picture?
Well, since 2015, the Washington Post has actually been compiling and tracking the information on police shootings in America, and it found that in 2015, for example, police officers killed 258 blacks. But you compare that to the number of white and Hispanic deaths, there were 662 white and Hispanic deaths in America in the same year. A whole lot more than the numbers for blacks, but the general argument is then that that doesn't matter because there are fewer black people in America. And so compared to the white casualties and white deaths, the rate of black deaths is higher. And so that is evidence of systemic racism. But such an argument really holds no water because when you actually do the proper mathematics, you can't use the numbers of the total population to measure such a metric because it's not the total population that is encountering the police every day. What you need to do is look at the amount of law enforcement encounters within the race. And when you look at that, it gives a better picture of what is actually happening because although black Americans are 13% of the population, they are responsible for 62% of all robberies, 57% of murders, 45% of all assaults in the 75 largest counties in the United States. Even beyond that, you look at the fact that, according to the FBI, over the last decade, black suspects have been responsible for 40% of all law enforcement deaths. And that actually means that per year, 54 law enforcement officers are killed by black criminals. You compare that to last year in 2019, the police shot 9 unarmed black people. And so you actually compare it, police officers are 6 times more likely to be killed by black suspects than blacks are to be killed by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Those are crazy numbers.
Yeah. So the idea that if we just redirect funding from the police departments into, like John Oliver talked about, things like stable housing, mental health services, and community organizations, they think that it's going to reduce the amount of criminality in the black population. And so then you're not going to need as much policing. That really seems to be just a phenomenal underestimation of how human nature works.
It's incredible idealism, really, because that is the least realistic thing that there is. Even before looking at the numbers that we've discussed already, it really doesn't make sense that if you police people less, then they're inclined to commit crimes less. Human nature acts the exact opposite way. You give it an inch and it'll take a yard. And to look at the way that things are in society today, there is no way that you can say that policing people less is going to result in less crimes being committed. I mean, even looking further into these numbers, one thing that really I really found interesting is the fact that although they say that the number of black deaths are a signal of just how much systemic racism there is in society, the actual figures show that most of the deaths and shootings and violent confrontations between police and criminals and black criminals are initiated by black police officers. Black police officers are more likely to engage violently with a suspect than white police officers are. Now, that's an incredible metric. And so you think of it, how is racism endemic when that is the statistic, that it's black officers who are more likely to engage in violent confrontations with the suspects? And then you start thinking, why is it that over the years you only hear of certain people like George Floyd who have been killed by white police officers? If there are so many deaths, why is it that there isn't much of an uproar every single time? And logic stands to reason that it's because it's not all white police officers who are responsible for the deaths.
You and I talked a while back about you're a native of Zimbabwe. Came to America for the first time. You've been in the country now for going on 2 years. It'll be 2 years at the end of the summer. And you were talking about the perception among your friends and just within Zimbabwe of life in America. Maybe you could just tell us kind of what your friends thought when you said, hey, I'm going to be going over to the United States.
Well, it was interesting when we spoke about it, because on one hand, back home, all that people generally watch is CNN or a lot of left-leaning television. And so people are like, oh, you're going to America where, you know, you're probably going to be confronted with a lot of racism and things like that, because that's what we hear America is like. And yet, despite that, they said, that's a whole lot better than what's going on here. So, yeah, you can take the racism as long as it comes with everything else. You'll be perfect because that's what we heard. And then I come here and I realize that it's very similar to what they said, except there's not much of the racism that I was promised. You know, they said that it would be terrible for me being a black, I'd be in danger, but I haven't experienced anything like that. And to be honest, you know, we'd speak back home about how it's really frustrating just all the noise that's made about how bad it is being in America. You know, when you compare it to anywhere else in the world, and it's like you can't even compare how much better it is to be here. That's why my friend said that you can take any of the problems that will come about over there, because compared to the blessings that you'll experience there, there's no point in even comparing it. And so there's actually a great deal of frustration sometimes with the way the entire thing is portrayed, because it's like, if you'd like to trade and you go to Zimbabwe and I come over here,
you'd take it in a heartbeat.
In a second.
Yeah. Yeah. What has it been like, I guess, just here you are in the middle of this, and not only watching what's happening in the United States, but you've been reporting on it, you've been studying into it and writing about it. Your personal perspective on just seeing the way that the United States is kind of tearing itself apart over this issue.
America isn't perfect, right? It's definitely not realistic to say that there is zero racism in this country, and there is never going to be a person who says something incorrectly or is uneducated on a subject, for sure. But the way that everything is just being politicized and blown out of proportion, and people are taking advantage of so many real issues, you know, that instead of being solved properly or being solved through violence and anger. I mean, one amazing example from a couple of years ago was when I think a white supremacist went and shot up a church, mm-hmm. Somewhere in the South. And the way the people reacted then was to forgive him. And that was an incredible example. And that, I'd imagine, is just so much better for moving on and for peace and for progress. And you look at America and its past, which isn't perfect, like any other country in the world, really, with human beings, because human beings are not perfect. The only way to move forward is forgiveness and to really look at the situation realistically, to look at the real numbers, to look at the real data.
Right.
And say, okay, this is what things are like, and it's not perfect, but it's definitely not sensible to say that you're going to try and correct a wrong with another wrong, because that just doesn't make any sense. And so it really makes me sad to see what happens in America, to see what is happening with the black people in America, who in many cases are being used to fuel these political agendas, because they are hurt, they do have these grievances that have taken place in the past, but they're not being allowed to see the truth, to see the reality on the ground today, because mm-hmm. the reality is much more different than what they're being told it is. And that really is a tragedy.
Well, thanks very much, Rufaro. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the Defund the Police movement in America today. And he's working on an article for thetrumpet.com about this subject, so you can watch for that there on the front page. Thanks so much for your time and your perspective, Rufaro.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Celtic Throne is a new dance production premiering in Armstrong Auditorium on June 28th, just 2.5 weeks away. All the final work is being put into making this the best, most inspiring show it can possibly be. And to talk about this, we have five of the people behind the production, directors Brad McDonald and Amy Fleury, who is my sister as well. Hello, sis.
Hello.
Assistant director Paris Turgeon and choreographers Alexa Turgeon and Vienna Fleury. So hello, everyone. It's great to have you all here.
Hello.
So this is crunch time, and I have to say I'm really excited to see how all of this comes together over these next couple of weeks. First of all, how are you guys all feeling at this point?
Excited.
Yeah, and it's nervous. Exhilarating. It's tiring and stressful, but also super exhilarating.
Cool. So I wanted to start by talking about the, maybe I can just direct this at Paris. You've been involved in the dance program kind of from the very beginning. We have a videotape of you as a cute little girl doing your first step two threes. So could you tell us a little bit about how this came about? This is a very ambitious plan here. Where did the idea originate and how did it develop?
Yeah, so I think the origin point for all of this kind of came about a year and a half ago. A year and a half ago around the conference, we did a pretty big recital for the ministry that was in town, and we decided to go ahead and try to perform the original choreography from Riverdance, and then we also did a hard shoe a cappella number, which I feel like those were kind of the two big standout numbers that left everyone just really amazed that we were able to do something of that caliber with our young people, because that's one of the focal points of the show is just how young our troupe is, and it's one thing that really sets us apart. So yeah, a year and a half ago we did this recital, essentially. It was just a recital, and these couple numbers just really blew people away, and it was my uncle's idea, Mr. Stephen Fleury, who said that, you know, I think we should do a full show, I think we should go on the road, I think we should tour. And that was kind of the brainchild for this whole production. And then from there, it's kind of just evolved, I guess. We ended up obviously getting that approved by Mr. Gerald Fleury, and he was definitely gung-ho. He loves Irish dancing. So he was definitely very supportive of that idea and has been very keen in basically helping us, you know, get the resources and the backing that we need to move forward with this project.
Mm-hmm.
He's our biggest fan.
He really
He's an idea guy, and he's also a good kind of engine of energy for this type of thing as well. So let's talk about the music, because that was a huge component in milestone in this coming together. You, Paris, you were also the one who kind of put the feelers out to see if we might be able to find a composer for this production.
Yeah, that's right. That was also Uncle Steven's, you know, his push there. I think that was one of the first things that we did to kind of start moving forward. And he just told me, put some feelers out for some musicians. And we were looking at, you know, more just competition musicians. So basically when you go to a dance competition, there's these musicians that sit on the side, they play the accordion, keyboard, you know, violin. And we were thinking, you know, maybe we could even just hire one of them to write some music for us, maybe have some electronic like synthesization also layered in there to kind of give us a fuller sound. But we were thinking of utilizing someone along that level. But in addition to those people, I think I emailed about three or four of them. In addition to them, I also emailed like Ronan Hardiman, who was the composer for Lord of the Dance, and then Brian Byrne, who did Heartbeat of Home, and then I think I even actually did Bill Whelan, who did River Dance, which was quite a ambitious, you know, one to try to get. I did not hear back from any of them except for Brian Byrne. He responded, and he was, you know, basically just said, "Your timing is great. This would be an awesome time for me to work on this." He's like, "I have kind of a lull in between projects, and so basically if you can give me what you want me to start working on, I'll get going on it immediately." So, and I think it started off by just having, you know, the opening number and the finale number, but then when we heard the opening number, you know, I think then it was like, we need to try to get this guy to write everything, because we were so moved by what he had created with the opening number. So then, yeah, that's basically how we got Brian, and we have this amazing soundtrack for this production.
Yeah, what do you guys think of the music? You've been listening to it a lot lately.
It's fantastic.
We love it. Love it. We love it the more we listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I get tired or stressed, I just turn the music on, and it gets me going again.
I actually listened to it as I was falling asleep last night, so...
And we played it for Mr. Fleury one Sabbath morning when he came over, and he just lit up. Just said, "This is fantastic.
There's nothing like it in this world." You know, we have some songs. There's a song called Pioneers where the setting is in early America. So there's banjos in there. There's these quintessentially American instruments. playing Irish dance music. You just don't find that sound anywhere else except for this show. And there's three or four pieces like that. You know, there's a song, Empire. I won't give away all of the details, but there's just these, well, I think there's green sleeves, or he's just weaved these melodies into an Irish dance song in a really, really special way.
Yeah. So the title of the show, Celtic Throne, and the, I guess the, like the quip or the subtitle is The Royal Journey of Irish Dance. Mr. McDonald, what does that mean? Maybe you could just tell us what the show is about.
Sure. So the show essentially follows a group of people, a nation, if you like, that migrate from Jerusalem, from the Middle East, through to Ireland, through to Scotland, through to England, through to the United States. So the show begins with one man on stage, you know, one king, if you like, of the people, and then the end of the first piece ends with all of the dancers on stage, and the audience is introduced to the whole troupe. This is the nation of people. On stage, we have a throne, which is really just a representation of this nation. And then from there, it just progresses. It begins in Jerusalem, origins, and then the next piece is farewell. This is the journey across the ocean. Then the next piece is festival, and this is you know, a dance performed maybe on the Hill of Tara in Ireland, a fesh in Ireland. Then after that,
that's where Irish dance,
right,
the origins are, and there's actually some evidence that those origins do go back to King David and the Middle East.
Right. Yeah, all of these dances here, we all attend feshes every Sunday, and that term is the longer term, I think, is feshiana, and if you study Irish history, that's really, it's referring to a Feast of Tabernacles like experience, an 8-day festival. So in our minds, when festival is being performed, the vision we have is this is like a family day at the Feast of Tabernacles. Mm. And it's just this really festive, fun, big, happy piece. And then from there it goes to Scotland, and then the throne or the nation of people, they move to England. And then there's Gael, which is a more tumultuous and violent song. And then second half, it opens with Pioneers. And the nation now is in America. And it remains.
That is a whole lot of fun, Pioneers.
Oh yeah, it's a big hoedown.
It's a hoedown, an Irish dance hoedown. It's kind of going back and forth between Irish dance and like other American folk dancing,
right,
that type of thing.
Yep.
Super, super cool.
Well, we're in America for two or three pieces. We have a really fun vocal medley in the middle of the second half, where Mark Jenkins and Mr. Malone come out, they play the piano, and they perform all of these, you know, famous patriotic tunes. Everyone in the audience is just going to recognize what they're singing and playing. It's just going to be a lot of fun. And then, you know, then we have a song called Conflict, where the nation runs into some trouble. It's war. It's downfall. There's some violence. And then the show ends in a new world. You know, the nation moves from America into a bright new utopian future, and the title of the final track is Utopia.
Mm-hmm. So, you've never done anything quite on a scale like this, Amy. This is kind of uncharted territory in some ways.
That's right.
Maybe you could just give us an idea of the scope of taking on a project like this, some of the details and the dimensions that you've had to wrap your head around to make it all come together.
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges was we wanted big numbers. Mr. Fleury always brings up the fact that it's so much better when you have the numbers, the big numbers that fill the stage.
Yeah.
Especially in Hard Shoe, he loves hard shoe.
That's the quintessential
pieces.
River dance kind of a thing.
Exactly.
You got the big line with the hard shoe.
And we've always struggled to get those numbers. So when we saw, when we had the performance for the ministerial conference, and we had a few out of town dancers join in, and they learned their parts as best they could ahead of time, and then they came a couple days ahead of time, and then participated in the practices, and it worked. And that just got us super excited because, well, could this work for, you know, a bigger production? Mm-hmm. And then could this allow us to finally get the numbers that Mr. Fleury always wants? So we just went for it, and we just hoped and prayed that God would help us out, because we knew that it would definitely, it would add more of a challenge, and it definitely has. But every step of the way, we've all just felt like, well, that challenge is, it's worth it, because God's going to bless it. He'll make it work.
So, well, what are the numbers? I think, doesn't the program say it's 37 dancers, or it's a lot of dancers altogether?
It might be 37 or 32. When you include, you know, our youngest dancer is 4.
Yeah.
We have, you know, 4 or 5 kids who are between 4 and 5 and 6, and then another 5 or 6 children who are between maybe 6 and 9 or 10. And they're not even our main troupe. And then we've got the main troupe, which is 16 to 20, 22, when you include the people coming in from Canada and Northeast America and Northwest America.
I have to say, those ones who are coming in from out of town are going to be so excited.
Oh, I know.
They're going to be dropped right into the middle of this amazing production.
We're so excited for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you've also got the music we talked about, but there are live musicians on stage that are adding to it. You mentioned Ryan Malone, and Paula Malone is going to be singing. Vienna, you're actually singing for a couple of the numbers. And so there's the live musicians aspect. There's the sets on the stage, and the lighting, and all those types
of things. Costumes.
The
musical
huge
break. I mean, it's a vehicle that has 7 or 8 different parts, and every part is really important. And they all interact. For me, that's one of the biggest challenges, is there's just all these different dimensions, and they've all got to interact perfectly. In a lot of cases, they've got to interact literally at exactly the same second.
Right.
So having everything, you know, work in that, at that level of detail is pretty challenging.
Yeah. Now, we were talking about there's a small handful of people who aren't even involved yet to this point. They'll be coming in within the next few days or so.
Right.
But we did have dancers on 2 different continents, because you've got your crew over in England, and then you've got your crew here in Edmond. How do you pull this off, where you're actually coordinating choreography for dancers that aren't even on the same continent?
We had one thing where there was a little program we used online, and we would have little people on there that we could move around, and that would help people see where they were in their spots. We'd also take, tutorials where we'd have the whole group dance them, and then we just basically tell them where their gap was, and then, or have somebody sub in for them, and then they would be able to watch that person as they went through the dance. And a lot of videos, sometimes just Vienna or I dancing, just so they get the footwork right.
Imagination. For Vienna and Alexa, they're choreographing a song that has 16. They'd only have 10 in class,
right?
And they just have to imagine the 6 gaps and try figure out how is this going to look.
Yeah,
it must have been so difficult.
Well, yeah. you're talking about this some kind of a program where you're moving little people around on the screen, because I mean, some of the formations are incredibly complex. There's so much happening with, I mean, I was thinking about what I was at the back of the stage watching Pioneers, and there's circles within circles and spinning in opposite directions and all of this type of thing. How do you make something like, was that the program that helped you to design some of that complexity?
Sometimes it's the program, sometimes you just have a ton of pieces of paper with little X's over it. Sometimes I would use big X's for the bigger kids, and then little ones to see where the little people were. And just playing around with that, you might have like 20 different pictures in a notebook, or else 40 different slides for a number on that program.
Alexa has a very good mind for that.
Yeah, I would guess.
She's very mathematical, and she comes up with formations.
Now, Irish dance is a very highly structured, and I'd say it kind of like there's a lot of strictures that are put on it. The arms have to be behind the back and that type of thing when you're doing like competition Irish dance. Maybe you could just talk a bit about the way that you've gone about choreographing this, because another thing that I noticed in watching each of these dances is they're all very unique. The music is kind of sets the tone, But there's kind of a whole movement vocabulary that's unique to each of these pieces. Maybe you could just talk about what went into designing each song to be special.
Well, I think, like for me, I think Alexa was probably the same. But when we think about choreographing things, we tend to do the feet first, and then at least I tend to do, once the footwork's done, then I'll incorporate like more arm movements. But the arm movements don't come as naturally as like the feet, the footwork does. So doing that has been hard. Like even I was working on some arms yesterday, and it's, you think you know the footwork, and then you try to insert the arms with it, and all of a sudden your brain is, there's too much going on. So you're just, you have to practice both separately and then just try and do it over and over and over again, slowly incorporating the arms with the feet.
Well, Amy, you have a lyrical dance background, and we actually have one dancer, Hannah Worrell, in the production who is a lyrical dancer with a strong ballet background, and she kind of adds a whole other dimension to it. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes. Well, we knew that it would be nice to have another layer like that. It was overwhelming to try to think about dealing with more people. So we didn't at the start, because it was just enough on our plates dealing with our own Irish dancers. But then we really found that there were a few gaps in the, when we listened to the music, we couldn't Irish dance to that part of the music. A lot of the introductions, for example. But it still required movement. You didn't want to just look at a blank stage for a minute. So then you just kind of needed somebody who could lyrical dance, that could, you know, kind of dance in and out of the beats. And Hannah, we knew that she had some skill, but we didn't know a whole lot about it. So we just asked her and just said, "Hey, can you just show us what you got?" And she was just had a great attitude, super positive. She just gave it her all, and she looks great.
She's awesome in the show. Yeah, the part she plays, yeah, I love.
What numbers, or say, as you're watching these things coming together, you're seeing this choreography, you're seeing things meshing for the first time, what are you finding yourself super excited about?
Well, the fact that we just see God's hand in it. God put that together. Oh, yep, he was thinking about that way before we were. Just lots of things like that.
I think going back to what you were asking about with the general outline of the show and the choreography, I think one of the things that Mr. McDonald stressed really early on was making each number unique and not having it just look like another Irish dance number. And I mean, ultimately what we do is Irish dance. We don't have backgrounds in anything else. Hannah is the only one that has any other background, at least to my knowledge. So I think there was so much thought that was put into each number, and I think that was part of the beauty of having so many opinions as well along the way. It was kind of like Alexa and Vienna would, you know, they'd make outlines for numbers, they'd run the outlines by my aunt, and then she would kind of give her thoughts and her feedback. It wasn't like, okay, we just dropped choreography somewhere and then tried to just run with it. We just really tried to be involved in every step of the process and just make sure there was a flow, and there was, but then at the same time, each number was unique. Like, I think that's one thing to me that really stands out is there's not a number I get bored watching, and there's not a number I'm like, I don't mind skipping this one. Like, they all bring something completely unique and completely special.
We haven't talked about it all that much, but the costumes are just off the chart amazing. And in terms of making each of the dances more unique, each of them, like, what you're seeing on the stage at any given moment is so different from what you're seeing at any other time, because everybody is dressed like $1 million in something that's like the Empire. I think it's the Empire where you have everybody in these kind of like Victorian era dresses and that type of thing. And then there's another one where they're in the red coats like they're British soldiers. Is that the same?
Different parts
of the same dance. But yeah, you see the girls going around with their parasols and the men in suits and all of that type of thing. It's just phenomenal. And then you have one with ribbons as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think the great thing about the storyline is that it really lends itself to that kind of variety. So then it's not just Irish dance, there's like, I looked up a lot of ribbon dancing, and so we have streamers in one number, they're kind of depicting waves, but they also come back throughout the show depicting different things.
I don't think the audience will be like, oh, it's just, this sounds similar to this song. Every single song is different and combined with a variety of dances and the variety of costumes. Like, I do think, like, it's already been said, but they'll love every number and you won't get bored of anything. So
Brian Byrne, he is a film score composer, and so I think a lot of people I know, they really like movie soundtracks.
Yeah.
So it kind of appeals to both audiences, people that love the traditional Irish sound and then also film scores, because there's really that sweeping orchestration mm-hmm. sound in a lot of his compositions. And so I don't think you cannot be moved when you're listening to his pieces, at least in some form, because they really are big and they can be pretty powerful and emotional, I think, too, especially when you see kids dancing
right.
to them.
Yeah, I remember early on we had a conversation about just trying to find music that was really inspiring
mm-hmm.
in terms of wanting to produce cool choreography and just that music that dancers really wanted to dance to. And lo and behold, this definitely fits the bill. It
and everything inspiring. Sprung. From the music,
mm-hmm.
it was just mm-hmm. we got it in synthesized form pretty early
right,
on,
right,
and then from there it just everything happened.
I mean, we gave Brian Byrne the outline. We told him the story we wanted to tell, and then he wrote music to fit the story.
Yeah,
this is really extraordinary from the standpoint of, you mentioned kids all the way to as young as 4 years old, but the oldest of them are basically the ones who are, I mean, we've got two that are dancing, sitting at the table here, that are in college. So you're not talking about folks with a long career in Irish dancing. This is essentially a bunch of high school and below, at college age at the top end.
And they're still in school.
And they're still in school. How has that been working to, you know, hours, what they've done, really hours a day of practicing once school got out. It's a lot of demands on some kids. How are they doing?
Yeah, I think it's been awesome. Now that we've started having rehearsals every single day and everything's choreographed, I feel like it's finally able to start sticking in their minds, because for a while there it was hard for them to remember, just because we're trying to learn.
I have no idea how they remember.
It's crazy. It really is crazy. But when you're trying to teach kids new choreographies, and sometimes you might not even touch a choreography for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden it's like, all right, let's run this number, and you see their minds like go blank, and they're just trying, the look of panic, honestly. So just now I feel like they're actually able to finally start remembering this. But when you look at the amount of dancing in this show, it's crazy just how much, you know, it's a lot to remember.
It's a lot.
And you look at Riverdance, Heartbeat of Home, Lord of the Dance, like they've all got different styles of dance incorporated in. It's not just Irish dance, but like we said earlier, besides Hannah, everything is Irish dance. So it's just, and
it's all them.
Yeah, it's all them. So
same kids on the stage over and over and over.
So they literally, they dance, they get off the stage, and they have to change within a minute or two and then get back on and remember what the next one is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These kids are working their tails off.
They are.
Yeah. Really, really hard.
And they're just a really, that's one of the things that's really special too, is Vienna actually tells me quite often, she just says, I just love working with these kids. We're just so close. Mm-hmm. We just have a lot of fun and we laugh. And yes, there are times when it's stressful, but there are a lot of times when, you know, she's telling me like, oh, we had the best laugh, this happened. And she loves even talking to them at services because they're just close.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to bring the dancers in maybe in next week or in a show sometime soon. So if they have a different story, we'll get to the bottom of it. So let's just finish by giving each of the opportunity to say what your favorite part of the show is. We'll start with you, Paris.
All right. Well, favorites are hard for me with this show because I feel like it changes depending on what's improving and what we're working mm-hmm. on at that moment. So it's really hard to narrow it down. I think right now, and probably because we spent a lot of time on this number recently, but Pioneers really does just stick out to me because I feel like it's going to be the most relatable piece for the audience. I think people are going to be like tapping their toes, like wanting to jump on stage with the kids because it is just so natural, and it's a hoedown. You want to get up there. They're just running around. I think especially for our kids, it's the easiest one for them to just have fun and relax because the other ones are probably more complicated in terms of footwork. So we are working with the kids on the showmanship, and we're going to be hitting that harder. But with Pioneers, it's way less work to get them there because you can just tell that they're enjoying it. So it just kind of comes out of them naturally. So yeah, I'm excited about that one. And I think the audience will really want to be involved, especially during that number.
Yeah. How about you, Alexa?
My favorite one, I think, is Conflict. It's just really intense and chaotic music. I think I've listened to that one like once a day since we got the final version just because it's just so interesting. And you hear more every single time you listen to it. Jude's been the lead choreographer for that one, and he just undertook a lot with that. So it's been amazing to see it come together because there's four soloists, and then there's like 16 people that are kind of going in all these different formations, sometimes moving super fast and getting to spots. And then basically reacting to the soloists as they go. So that's been a lot of work that the kids aren't really used to, but we've been working for hours and hours on it in the past couple weeks, especially since Jude was able to come over from England. And it's been amazing because all the dancers you can tell think it's cool. So they're all pushing as hard as they can. Because even whenever those guys are dancing, like we're all trying to see what they're doing. And then we try to react to it at the right time just so it's more impactful.
Yeah.
But I think that one's going to be really exciting for the audience.
That is a super, super dramatic number. How about you, Amy?
Well, I'm kind of like Paris. I have different favorites at different times. But I think just in general, I really like seeing the guys. Like, it's partly the music, but they step up to it and they're just dancing more masculine than I've ever seen them dance, and
they look
dancing
studly.
They do. They're confident. They look strong and masculine, and it just is like, wow, it's just really impressive. And I love them in Gale. I love them in Conflict. Yeah. And then when they come out in Utopia with these amazing costumes, I couldn't help but, you know, wow, you know, in the audience. Yeah, we're just all screaming because they just look just so studly.
Vienna.
I mean there's not one number in this show where I get bored, but I would think that probably the best one, at least in like just formations and then also just intensity along with Conflict, is Gale, which my mom mentioned. But just I love it because it's so like there's so many emotions in this one dance. It's kind of talking, like, it's just troubling, like, and it's dark on the stage with, like, flashing lights and everything, so it's just very, like, I would say that it kind of puts the audience, like, on edge, like, what's gonna happen? Like, something's coming, but you don't really know what's gonna happen, and,
the music is super cool.
It's super cool. Lots of drums, lots of, like, just a really good beat, in the music, and then a really awesome guy's part in the beginning, and then we've got a mixture of soft shoe and contemporary as well, and then like just a dramatic hard shoe ending. So I love seeing that, and you know, we were working on that this morning, and just seeing like the kids look stronger, and you know, their arms are getting all like nice and tense and everything, like everything is just finally coming together, and it's just really cool because you can see them, like their love for it growing too.
Yeah.
And especially
they're
definitely excited, and I think whenever you know they get that reaction like, wow, that was awesome, it just makes them even more pumped to do it better the next time. So I would say that Gale is probably one of my favorites.
Cool. How about you, Miss Marie?
I'll give you two really quick. The first one is in Festival. We have a violin face-off. And those violinists will be playing live. And then that transitions into a little duel between Jude and Jordan, our two, you know, lead dancers or lead male dancers. That's just really fun, energetic. It's just a really neat moment. Then another moment I love is after Conflict, which is dark and scary and even a little bit creepy, it transitions into Utopia. Before Utopia, we have four or five vocalists singing a tune Mr. Malone wrote called Tomorrow's Light. And it's just a magnificent moment. These four vocalists or five vocalists come out. They sing Tomorrow's Light, which the melody is the same melody that's in Utopia. Mm-hmm. And then all of the dancers come on stage and they sing. Like all of mm-hmm. these kids that have been dancing mm-hmm. now sing as a chorus this epic, beautiful song.
Yeah.
And then they go back and they get ready and they finish the show by dancing the final song.
It's a dynamic duo. Yeah. Tomorrow's yeah. Light that goes into Utopia. It's just yeah. beautiful.
And it's such a relief after conflict.
Yeah. Yes.
The way it just, you know, conflict yeah. stirs up all these like kind of negative emotions, and then, you know, Tomorrow's Light, it brings that hope.
Release.
And yeah, the kids are actually singing. They can dance and they can also sing as well. So yeah. I think yeah. that's pretty impressive.
Coming from Vienna, who is actually one of the five vocalists yeah. right. on yeah. that.
But the others can sing too.
Yeah.
They're the ones, they actually recorded the chorus.
The dancers in the studio,
the real singers.
Pretty awesome. We've been talking with the crew of Celtic Throne. June 28th is the premiere at 2 in the afternoon, Central Daylight Time. So come to Armstrong Auditorium if you can. If you're within a drive of Edmond, Oklahoma, you can pick up tickets at armstrongauditorium.org. It will also be available to see online. Mr. McDonald, tell us about that.
That's right. There'll be two shows streamed online. The June 28th performance will be for PCG members only. The July 5th performance at 2 p.m. Central Standard Time will be for the entire world. So it'll be live streamed on Armstrong Auditorium. People will be able to tune in and buy a ticket for that. We're charging $5 per ticket, which... to hear Brian Burns' original new music for the first time ever, I think is pretty good value.
Marvelous.
But seeing it live will be a time.
You got to see it on live
if you can. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you can.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate
you
all coming.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Watching the news, it feels like the world is crashing in. So many life-altering events are happening in such rapid succession, it's difficult to keep up or make sense of it all. But there is great cause to hold your head high. World events are hurtling toward the greatest news story ever to occur. Jesus Christ provided a detailed description of what would transpire globally just before this event. The Bible contains dozens of major prophetic events to watch for and hundreds of additional events. Toward the end of his ministry, Christ delivered the tremendous Olivet prophecy. You can read it in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. This was his response to the disciples' earth-shaking question, "What shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" So here is Jesus Christ's explanation of the world conditions that would precede his second coming. He began by describing the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which bring false religion, wars, famines, and disease epidemics. You can compare verses 4 through 8 in Matthew 24 with Revelation 6, verses 1 through 8. And these include other horrific events you can read about in verses 9 through 11. But then he spoke about a falling away within his own church in this end time. That's in Matthew 24, verse 12. So that puts the time frame right into our day today. If you want more information about what has happened within God's church, just write us a copy for Raising the Ruins, and it'll explain it to you thoroughly. So Christ also tells us how to survive these events. He says in verse 13, "But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved." According to Jesus, there will be people spared from these nightmares. Then verse 14 says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." Right in the middle of these crises is a prophecy about a work of God. Whether or not you believe it, this prophecy has already been fulfilled. Through the World Tomorrow television program and the Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong warned the world for 50 years with an intense prophetic message. And now through the Key of David program and many publications, television and radio programs and websites, the Philadelphia Church of God is prophesying again, even more intensely, as fulfilled prophecy reveals we're even closer to the end. In Matthew 24 and verse 30, we see what all these signs lead to, Jesus Christ's second coming. Yes, world conditions are bad and they're getting worse, but we need to focus on the connection between all the bad news and this most spectacular, hope-filled event ever. Verses 32 to 33 say, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So likewise you, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors." So Jesus Christ is saying, we'll know the end of this age is near by watching as the specific signs he's given us are fulfilled step by step by step. Why would God give us all these prophecies and then tell us to watch for them? He did that because he is warning us. He isn't just going to spring these calamities on the world. He's giving plenty of warning. That warning includes God's admonition to repent, to turn from the sin that is causing all these disasters. He says in Ezekiel 33 and verse 11, "Say unto them, as I live, says the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel?" We're told individually to watch. Jesus Christ's prophecy, as recorded in Luke 21, concludes this way, "Watch you therefore and pray always." And why is that? "That you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." So to escape these nightmares coming on the world, we have to watch and pray always. And what can happen if you're not vigilant? We'll read verses 48 through 51 back in Matthew 24. That shows that our attitude about Christ's return, our urgency and excitement about those signs he has given us, has a direct relationship with our personal conduct. When you're looking for the day of Jesus Christ's return, that gives you the perspective that should translate into a desire to seek God's way of life. It spurs you to actively prepare for what is coming. So what's happening in the world today makes plain that the prophesied great tribulation is coming. It's coming very soon. Conditions are only beginning to get worse. Already, there are a lot of people who recognize something is dangerously wrong. And the worse events become, the more people are going to despair. But God tells us to maintain a broader perspective. As conditions decay, we must not become depressed. Remember, always remember where it is all leading. It says in Luke 21, verses 27 to 28, "And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near." Keep a posture of vigilant, hope-filled anticipation. The worse things get, the greater should be our hope. The more vigilant we are, the more we diligently watch and pray, the more filled with hope we will become. All this bad news is pointing toward the event this world desperately needs. You can learn more about that by reading our booklet, A Pivotal Sign of the End Time. Lift up your head. Jesus Christ is about to return. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Rufaro Manyepa, Brad McDonald, Amy and Vienna Fleury, and Paris and Alexa Turgeon. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe: difficulties increase the nearer we come to our aim. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.